So here I am. So I'm saying we should be helping by helping them to understand the Western world system that sadly is the system that we live in.
Well, it is, and there's no going back.
No, and as Dad says, our people have been adopting our lives for thousands of years. I mean, when you consider, really, we've had less than, well, really just over 50 years of actually trying to assimilate into a Western world culture. Because that's when we were given, in some ways, that ability to have some semi-acceptance in our larger community. So therefore, we've done pretty good in a short amount of time. But the thing is, so here I am, I'm saying it's up to us to help facilitate, get them to understand this, the concept of the Western world. You know, like that old saying, you know, we can give a boy a fish or we can teach a boy to fish.
Yeah.
And in the end, you know what the answer was? Oh, let's put a barbecue up once a week. Because when we got the barbecue going, they're all good when we got the barbecue going. And I'm going, yeah, of course they are, because they want a sausage.
Yeah.
But you've only got the sausage happening once a week at lunchtime. What do you think they're going to be doing for every other day of the week and every other hour of the moment of the day?
Yeah.
It's like, so I banged my head against the wall, walked out. I'm thinking, this is lunacy.
It is.
And we're just creating our people to be reliant and
it's so short-term.
It is. And you wonder why we're not getting the shift. And that's why I'm saying to my own people, that old saying, you know, you can only change yourself. And we've got to start, you know, I'm not saying don't stop asking for our rights and stuff. But what I'm saying is, that squeaky wheel is not getting oiled. So we're better off spending our time and energy, like an elder said to me the other day, we can't look at ourselves as individual groups too much. We've got to actually look at ourselves corporately and start going, well, how do we change our lives? How do we stop our children getting into child protection? How do we stop our children getting into justice system and having poor education? Well, that comes from us. And, you know, when I look at it, you know, like I look at Mum and Dad, I mean, really, they have done a marvellous job, community and family, because what did they do? Here they were, two Aboriginal people that had seven kids, yet all of their children went to school, ended up having jobs and families and contributing to community and carrying on cultural values and that, and avoided the justice system and these things that certainly impacted us, and because they were determined to make sure that their next generation of family didn't have the things that they didn't have, which was, you know, homes and education and wealth and all that sort of stuff. And they don't have much. They still live in housing trust home and rub two coins together is about all they can do for finances and week by week, and so it can be done. Yes, it's hard, but it's a mind shift and it's a willingness. And, you know, like I said, you know, people can say, oh, you got more. Well, like I said, I didn't grow up with a lot, but I just had parents that were determined to change the outcomes for us as a family, and I think that's where it all starts, from the home.
So the Adelaide Chronicles that we're trying to set up, we want to set up a centre for unlearning. We want people to unlearn a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
Where would you start in unlearning?
Well, good question. Well, I think the real way of unlearning, and this is going to sound obviously a little bit biased, but is really understanding those cultural values. Because when you look at some of the things, and which is what I try to teach and actually put into a current Western world thinking, you know, like when I told you about, you know, sometimes I'll draw lines with Christian values. If you look at Genesis, it talks about everything was created from the earth. What is Aboriginal spirituality? We believe everything was created from the earth. You look after the earth, it looks after you. What do Christian people do that Aboriginal people didn't do? Well, Christian people now so focused on giving themselves Christian values, but what they've forgotten is the Christian connection also is the animals and the plants and the land, but they don't put Christian values into the plants, animals and land. They only put it in the person.
And they call it dominion.
Yeah, whereas if you look at Aboriginal people, their spirituality starts from the land, which is, you know, if you look after the land, it's going to look after you. So therefore, this the land owns you. You don't own the land. That's their philosophy. You know, we're custodians in that. And therefore, but you're taking that approach. When you look at it from a land basis, then you actually remove the selfishness and the human importance.
You take the me out.
Yeah, because as we know, the land's here, been here before us. It'll continue to be here after us. Mm. Therefore, our time on this land is very short. So therefore, what do we do in that time? And we're so interested in wealth building. But and I'm not saying we shouldn't build wealth. But you build wealth so that you can give to others. That's what it's all about. And that's what I've done. Like, you know, and this is not me painting myself as a hero. As I said earlier, Mum and Dad still live in Hantra. They don't have too much. And I now can afford to buy my home. I can afford to go on a holiday or whatever. And so when things, Mum and Dad need things, like their washing machine breaks down, whatever, not just me, sometimes it's the whole family. We'll rally together and we'll put it and we'll give it to them. And they'll go, oh, no, no, you shouldn't do that. You know, go, yeah, we should. Because we wouldn't have these things if it wasn't for you. Not just because you gave us life, but because you taught us the values and that mechanism of understanding about supporting one another and connection. And so, you know, for me, I think we've missed a huge amount of knowledge and wisdom from the Aboriginal people, because you don't live for tens of thousand years if you haven't learned something. And we understood, one of those unteachings is, Dad does, which Dad taught me, and he still teaches people, the string trick stuff. I don't know if you've seen Dad do the string trick. Now, people think it's just a trick. Well, no, it's not. And yes, he's doing it in a caption and a simplistic mode, but what he's telling is, we're going to use our listening ears, our observing eyes, our imitating and doing hands. That's what our people did. And so therefore, when you do those things, it means you have to take time, you have to take a moment, you have to be persistent and practice and continually connect. Whereas what are we now doing? I'm not saying I'm much better, but here we are on these things all the time. It's telling us the answers to everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Totally. You don't think anymore. You just look up.
You do. So it's telling us the answers to everything in life. It's telling us how we speak and how we say things. It takes us away from the physical connections to the land and that. So we look at beautiful places, beautiful people, beautiful food, beautiful clothing, but we don't go out and touch it or make it or feel it or see who it comes from and where it and how it's made or whatever. And, you know, it's like I get so amazed, you know, like I was lucky because I grew up in a large family. So I learned to cook, clean, sew, knit, mend, those things, right? Now, I know it sounds a bit sexist and it's not meant to be sexist. And those things were taught to me by Mum, right? Dad taught me how to build, how to fix things, how to maintain things, all those things, you know, like cars and a home and all that sort of stuff. So I got all those skills off them. And they were learnt by physically doing those things. And I get so amazed, like people, particularly young generation, they say, oh, I don't know how to cook. I can't fix the car. I can't paint that wall. I can't fix that cupboard door or something. And you think, why? This doesn't take intelligence. It's not saying you've got to be like a tradesperson or a master chef. What it's saying is that saying, as I said before, it's about teaching you to fish and not just giving you the fish. And that we live in the society today, and it's like, what do we promote? Uber. Oh, Uber's got to deliver me my food. My daughter's even had it. She's paid for delivery of food.
Uber Eats. That's fantastic.
Why don't you go, no, I'm going to get a tutor and he's going to teach me how to cook.
The world has changed so much, hasn't it?
It has.
But I think we're on a precipice. I think that we need to do something now. I really think that to have a future that can include all of us, we've really got to work together. And I think it's more important now than ever.
Well, and this facility that you live in is, without sounding belittling, as much as it does, is still really not enough.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, as we've just witnessed, where our farmers are now massively suffering because they provide, well, really, our food. The thing is, what we should be doing as a nation now, if we're really thinking, you know, more climate change, we're thinking more environmental understandings like recycling and all this sort of stuff, well, if we want to reduce things like plastic bags and all these things, the only way to really do that is we've got to go back to the old days, which is localising things.
That's right.
So when you localise things, it means, you know what, I don't really need a fridge anymore to this massive scale, and freezer particularly.
Mm.
Now what I, because the fact is, I allow the shopkeeper to hold all the goods and that, because it means I get out of my house, I walk down the shop, he can now give it to me fresh.
Yeah.
And I'm supporting him, he's supporting me, and he's only going to give me seasonal stuff because it's either locally made or whatever, and therefore we don't have to drive. So therefore, we don't put more pollution in there. So we're not spending more money on better cars or whatever.
And we don't need massive supermarkets.
No, we don't need massive supermarkets. Storaging stuff and then throwing it all away. And so therefore, we need to be start thinking about localising things and going back to as simply as your market. If you look at public housing, what it used to do, or any house, anybody that used to build a house in the old days, you had to actually put in a number of food elements in it, which was you had to put in fruit trees.
Mm.
Because that was about saying, we want you to be partly sustainable. And if you look
so
at a lot of...
feed yourself.
Yeah. And what it, and if you looked at a lot of public housing and certainly early housing, they had a lot of fruit trees in it.
Yeah.
If you go to a lot of places today, you won't see any hardly any fruit trees. They'll have beautiful plants, beautiful flowers. Don't get me wrong, they still add value because we know bees create most of our food anyway because of the pollination and stuff. But the thing is, we're not being self-sustainable when... Again, I don't want to be targeting people to some degree, but when you look at people in some ways, when we look at how there's meat lovers and vegetarians, well, we're lucky to some degree as vegetarians even, because if we didn't have farmers mass producing these things, it would be hard for us to be completely vegetarian, because the fact is you would have to eat seasonal things, but it didn't get grown in large quantities, so therefore, you know, you could only eat what was in season, and you could only eat, in a sense, in scattered amounts, because you couldn't take it all from the tree or whatever, because otherwise that tree won't be there.
Yeah.
And so you don't understand those elements of impact and understanding. And so, you know, and it's the same with even as meat lovers, you know. Like I remember one somebody told me, I said, oh... And this is a reverse thing. I said, oh, I'd love to catch a kangaroo with a woomera and a spear. They said, look, brother, this old jubby fella said, he said, look, let me tell you, if I put woomera and spear on a table, Toyota car keys and a rifle on the table, which one do you reckon the black fella's going to take? He's going to take the Toyota and rifle every time, because it's bloody hard catching a kangaroo.
Yeah.
You know, because they run quick.
Yeah.
And you've got one spear. And... you're going to go run after it and the kangaroo gone.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And you can't farm kangaroos.
No, you can't really farm them. They're, you know, they're wild animals. Yeah. And, I mean, we did do some farming, oddly enough. And what's his name? That author, Bruce Pascoe, talks about that, particularly in that his book, Dark Emu, and, which is wonderful. And Bungara are now doing a dance on Dark Emu. And you know, he did say that we collected seeds and we stored them and things like that. But it's interesting, you know, it's like we really need to when you say, when you talk about uneducated, we really, uneducating is actually saying we've actually got to, in my opinion, re-educate on those cultural things, like not just the myths and the traumatic stuff I'm talking about. People didn't realise that we really are the oldest bread makers in the world. People thought that we introduced bread to them. Well, no, we used to grind up seeds and make our own bread. Then it's the same with recently when I was doing a little bit of a research myself. As much as it's impacted on our people hugely, but we did make drinks, right? And some of them were probably alcoholic drinks. But the difference is we drank them at seasonal times and specific purposes and all these sorts of stuff.
It's just mass production, isn't it? Farming of everything.
Mass production, it is.
And just having everything available year-round.
Yeah.
Shelves and shelves of it. It's so wrong.
And it is. We've got to change our thinking. And I think, and you know, it's like I did the Governor's Leadership Foundation program. It was great. It was scary for me and very intimidating because I was the only Aboriginal there was another Aboriginal fellow on there. And many of them were educated people. You know, they were, you know, university degrees and like that. And so it was kind of confronting at times. Anyway, we went to a lot of forums and workshops and things, and one of them we went on a number of times was climate change. And what I found fascinating about climate change was you had the sceptic and the non-sceptic.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And what surprised me is both of them agree on Mother Nature's system, which is evaporation, rainfall on the land, back into the waters. It's a circle.
Yeah.
It's a cycle, right? They both agree. Nothing different there. They both agreed that the world will have a 2% minimum increase in its temperatures. The only difference is the person who wasn't saying, which is the non-skeptic, is saying that you know, Mother Nature has got control of this, not man.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're saying it could go to 4% because if we don't reduce our pollutions and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's still a voice. And so we're spending, my point, what I'm trying to raise here is, so one say it's Mother Nature, one saying a lot of it's man-made. My point that I'm trying to raise is that we're spending a lot of money on trying to work out, is it Mother Nature or is it man-made? Because I've also heard two theories too. Is it global warming or global dimming?
Dimming.
Right, so global warming works on the fact that the ozone layer's got less, therefore the sun's heating us up, and therefore that's why we're getting hot temperature. Global dimming works on the fact is, basically, we've become like an insulation bat. The heat's just been trapped in. Can't escape.
Yeah.
It's just been trapped in. So that's why you're not getting evaporation of waters, because basically the heat's trapped. So that's interesting, but the thing is, I think we should spend money and time, but not the amount of money and time we are spending on just trying to prove is it Mother Nature or whatever, because, as I said, we can only control ourselves, and we're trying to, and I think we should still influence the world and stop people, but as we know, some countries are not and whatever. So therefore, what I'm saying is, let's think about a world that is not only going to be, we know, 2% hotter, but how can we live in that world that doesn't have reliance on fossil fuels? So let's think about that.
Mm.
But we're not. We're still spending this time on proving it, yet we're still spending our time using fossil fuels and all this sort of stuff. Because as I say to some people, you know, you can't type in your phone now or the internet and go, design me a car that'll run on non-fossil fuels for the future. It's not going to be able to do it because somebody has to create that. Somebody has to think about that and understand how to do that. And so, therefore, let's spend the time on and money on people doing that rather than trying to prove, is it man or...
Yeah, because what does it matter? If it's happening, it's happening.
Well, it still matters because we still need to stop doing it.
Stop it.
But let's stop doing it by creating a world that doesn't actually create you to do it in the first place, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And as I tell this cultural story where modern man comes to the elders and he says, hey, elder, your people lived this earth for thousands of years. Our world is warming and we need your wisdom and knowledge to understand what to do. Elder ignores him. Elder, come on, this is serious stuff. This is very important. We need to know how we can change the world because your people have lived for tens of thousands of years. Surely they know something. And the elder continues to ignore him. So the modern man realizes, oh, he's not listening, he's whatever. So he decides, I'm going to take a different tack. And he sees that the elder is sitting in this group with other elders and they're doing something. So he says to the elder, hey, elder, what are you doing there? And could I sit with you? And he invites him down to sit and he said, what are you making there? And he said, we're making cloaks. And the modern man goes, but Elder, I've just talked to you about how I've just said the world's heating up. Why would you need a cloak? He says, what follows great heat is great cold. So therefore, when great cold comes, we won't be able to make these cloaks. So what he's saying is, you got to prepare for the future, and therefore you got to think about the future. What can you do in the future? Well, you can't make cloaks in winter because you don't have the animals or the sources or the ability to do that, and it's too late. You're going to be freezing, or you're going to be you're not going to have those needs. And so therefore, it's about understanding those needs and those values. It's not saying that he's accepting that after great heat, great cold will. It's about saying that you have to live in harmony and you have to have understanding, and that's where observation and listening comes from generations.
Absolutely. That's a really good way of putting it.
And, you know, we've got to stop worrying about...
Seasons follow each other.
Well, they do.
Yeah.
They do. And Dad will say, oh, we had seasons within seasons. It wasn't just the four seasons.
Yeah.
Because we forget about the wind.
Yeah. Windy season and
we forget about the fire season.
Yeah.
We don't cast them as seasons.
No, but they're just as significant.
They are.
To the land.
Didn't know anything. We weren't a developing.
So not people to listen to.
No, because what could they teach us? They're living like cave people.
Mm.
They can't teach us anything. But the thing was, we understood the land and we understood all those importance of harmony and value, and like we did, like a lot of the medicines come from Aboriginal people because we understood the plants and all those sorts of things. We didn't get sick and stuff, and so you know, and even when you look at David Unipin, who's an inventor, you know, he talked about putting boomerangs together to give you vertical lift helicopters. He talked about concentration of light because our people used light to burn things and create fires and lasers was what he was talking. Then he talked about the earth having energy. And so therefore he said you could have basically non-conductive transfer of energy and stuff, being, which is what we see with mobile phones now. You don't plug the cord hardwire. It's done by magnetic exchange. And so he understood that. And we understood that our people being living and breathing people, and partly we get sick a lot of the time is because we actually don't put our bare feet and bodies on the ground anymore. Therefore, energy, because we're still energy, is now being insulated by ourselves because we wear rubber-soled shoes and therefore, you know, and we cover ourselves up so much, and then we still got to be mindful of the sun and that, but... You know, so we're not getting our vitamin D's and all these sorts of things that the sun gives us the life and the ground gives us balance and harmony. And like I said, when you connect with that, then all of a sudden things fit better. But, you know, we don't. We actually live isolated. You know, I remember growing up in the streets of public housing and living in those streets. It was our playground. It was our learning. It was ground and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I now have become like most people, drive into my driveway, drive out of my driveway, and I'll wave to a neighbour, but you never talk to the neighbour.
Yeah.
Well, I do, but in principle, not to the extent of what you did.
No, we're gated.
You know, like your kids, you know, I remember growing up with my neighbours, the kids of the neighbours, whereas today my kids don't grow up with the neighbours' kids, they grow up with their school friends. But not the neighbours, you know, they don't play in the streets or anything like that because we've become this overprotective society now. You know, I get worried, like my daughter's now learning to drive. But I'm not teaching her just the mechanics of the car. I'm teaching her how to understand the road and be defensive and aware, because she never rode her bike to school. And when you ride your bike to school, that's how you learn awareness and all that understanding of getting to places and all that,
and speed.
Yeah, it did. But they don't. They don't learn that now, and because they're isolated, and so we're creating these dangers to our future generation people, without realizing that the things that we're doing is becoming overprotective and over isolating, and in some ways we're just giving the answers to our generations rather than letting them work it out. You know, I remember one of the stories Dad tells, which is about inquiring ears. And he says, as a young fellow sitting with his grandmother, who would talk about wisdom and knowledge, and he would interrupt her with questions. Oh, and she would get upset and walk off. And he did this on a number of occasions, and each time she would walk off. But then one time he decided, well, I'm not going to interrupt. I'm going to listen to the story and the information. And so the answer there is that when you listen to all the information, you have this inquiring ears, which is greater knowledge and greater wisdom and greater learning. Because what happens is questions that you have now become the problems in the story that's of the information that's been told. So therefore you work out the answer because the information is given to you. So therefore you have to find the answer in the information rather than going, for argument's sake, to keep it simple. It's like, well, you know, if somebody tells me 2 times 3 is 6, well, I haven't worked out anything. I just know that two and three is six, isn't it? And so therefore, if we're just given the information, like, for argument's sake, you've got 6 objects. Oh, yeah, that I can see that there's 3 lots of 2 objects, or there's 2 lots of 3 objects, or there's 6 of 1 object. So therefore, you're working it out, aren't you?
Mm.
And like Dad talks about, when we talked about in mathematics, in today's society, we talk in ones. Our people talked in multiples. You know, like we could only really, in some ways, only counted to 5 as such. But then we were able to count in 5s, so to speak, rather than seeing it as ones. Because Dad tells a story about, you know, when our people, particularly in those early farming days, were given the responsibility to count the sheep. Well, most people go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 20, 21, 22, 23. Whereas they used to go 5, 10, 15, you know, and so therefore they could get through it and they understood how, and so therefore what that meant was they could look at it and go, oh yeah, there's 20 sheep over there in one go because they knew what 20 looked like. They didn't look at it as one sheep, therefore they could see large numbers.
Mm.
And so, you know, so that's an interesting understanding, you know, and it's used in our language. Like when you look at the fact that, you know, our people, when you talk about, Dad talks about, like, just even saying hello, like ninamani is hello to an individual. But when we talk in a large group, we go mani na budni, you know, and so therefore we had these, it wasn't like we see in English, you know, you just add S to it on the end of a word, that means that's multiple, isn't it? Whereas we had these different things, it might be ana, or it might be icha, or it might be something like that, which gave the differences of, are you talking to one person, 3 people, or a crowd of people? And so there was multiples in the language itself. And so it's sort of interesting when you, and that's why sometimes, you know, not being a language expert, because I'm not, you know, sometimes we look trapped and when we look at languages and we go, oh, yeah, like we teach at school, let's teach Japanese or German or French. But how many of us are going to go to Germany and go to Japan? Or sure, there'll be some of us. Some of us will use it. And sure, we've got people that come from the nation groups that come here and we'll be able to use it with them. But really, that's not why we teach language. You teach language because it gives you an understanding of their culture, gives you an understanding of how their language works and why they use it in those contexts and stuff. And so therefore, what we should be doing is we shouldn't be afraid to teach Aboriginal languages to people, because then they can see and understand the culture, the add-on. Because when you see people that teach language, all of a sudden they move and shift over into what? Food. Then they took the clothing, what they did on the land and how they worked, and then they looked at all those other cultural elements, dance and music, and so there's multiplies.
Mm.
Which, but when we talk about, oh, I was just going to teach Japanese, they didn't just teach Japanese and speaking it and writing it. They go to all the other levels, and that's why we should be going in the schools and say, no, we're going to go to teaching Aboriginal languages. Yeah, we've got to choose. We know there's 250 of them. Well, let's just choose the ones of the local people. And that way, not only when we see dual naming of places, we can understand what that word means and stuff, and we can converse. And then we don't have to, you know, always be having the Aboriginal person come up the front and say, Nina Marnie, to welcome everybody. We can do it in language, and we can do it in a sense of cultural connection, because we've learnt the language and we've embraced it. But then we move on to the other layers, the foods, the dance, the songs, the art, the concepts of harmony and land and stuff like that. And it just, yeah, saddens me that we want to know that we're the oldest living culture in the world, but yet we don't celebrate it or embrace it as a nation. We'll whack a flag up. We'll talk about it on occasions around specific times like NAIDOC Week or Reconciliation Week or National Apology Day and all this, but that's as far as it goes, really, isn't it? Because as soon as we start talking about treaty or talking about colonisation and removing Captain Cook, who got I discovered Australia, even though it was here, mate. And as Dad would say, we as Aboriginal people discovered Captain Cook, as he says. You know, we get afraid of it, don't we? Because we think all of a sudden, we're going to lose something. And oh, it's going to cost us money.
Where does that fear come from?
The fear comes from because of our education system, because we think that because we talk in ownership. We don't talk in connection and understanding. I mean, it's amazing. Recently, I couldn't believe it. I came across a girl, her name was Tandanya.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not an Aboriginal girl.
Wow.
And I said, how come your name's Tandanya? I thought she was maybe changed it herself or...
Yeah.
She said, no, my parents named me Tandanya because they went to the opening of Tandanya 26 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And loved this period when they were at the Tandanya opening and seeing all this wonderful culture, and obviously loved that, you know, the meaning behind Tandanya, which is, you know, the dreaming place of the big red kangaroo, and said, yeah, we want to call you Tandanya. So she called it Tandanya. And before that, a number of years ago, because I get fascinated, you know, and I love people, not so much the ones today, but